Welcome to New Books in Film. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today I'll be speaking with Mick Broderick, author of the book Reconstructing Strangelove, Inside Stanley Kubrick's Nightmare Comedy, published in 2016 by Wallflower Press. Mick has written extensively on the issues of atomic warfare and media, giving him a unique perspective on Kubrick's most outrageous film. Welcome to Mick Broderick. Hi, Mick. I'm glad to speak with you.
Hey, thanks for having me on your program.
My historical studies also included the Cold War, so I found your book to be fascinating for a variety of reasons. But let's start with your background. Podcast is devoted to authors, so I always like to get a little more details about the background of the authors, including educational and writing experiences, and I know yours are pretty extensive. So if you want to give us a little bit of your background, that would be great.
Sure. Well, I was born in Melbourne, Australia in 1959, and that was the year that Stanley Kramer brought Hollywood to town to film On the Beach. So in some kind of bizarre way, in my cultural DNA growing up in Melbourne as a kid, I'd always heard about this film that was made when I was really an infant about the end of the world. And it wasn't until, I guess, the late 1960s when I was watching a lot of science fiction television, espionage shows, and they seemed to be full of stories about atomic energy, both as some kind of utopian, libertarian way of saving the planet or destroying the planet through, you know, malicious use. And in that kind of dichotomy, there was a range of stories, you know, from all around the world. Australia in those days, we had very limited local domestic television production, so we imported a lot of American, British, and in some cases Japanese and French programming. So we were awash with other cultures' perspectives, particularly during those Cold War periods, of, you know, television dramas that depicted these types of themes. And when I started my undergraduate study in media and communication in Melbourne, I started thinking about a third-year communications research project. And this was in the very early 1980s. And again, there was this kind of neo-Cold War sensibility that was being discussed and debated around the world. And a range of film products were responding to those fears and those concerns. So I started, you know, putting two and two together and drawing some historical conclusions about where did these films about nuclear war start and were there peaks and troughs that you could match historically against real events? Did Hollywood and did other kind of film production countries in the UK and Japan preempt and prophesy some of these things that we saw on film, or were they reacting to geopolitical events? So I took this long historical view that ended up becoming a book, a project that was funded by one of our cultural institutions here, the Australian Film Commission, in the late 1980s, and that was called Nuclear Movies. And that was a filmography that effectively gave very terse, brief summaries of the subject matter, the content, the themes, iconography of the way nuclear energy had been represented historically and internationally. And the first edition of that, I noted about 500 feature-length films from around the world. And by the second edition that was picked up by McFarland a few years later, I was up to nearly 1,000 feature films, ranging from 1914 through to 1991. And in that process, one of the dominant films, of course, was Dr. Strangelove. It was unparalleled, unprecedented, and really unmatched in many ways by any film that preceded it or came afterwards. So, of course, I had this abiding interest in wondering how Strangelove came about. Like you, my first Kubrick film was 2001, which I saw as an eight-year-old in Melbourne. Can't even remember what the Cinerama, but it was very impressive. It knocked my socks off. I was a bit of a sci-fi geek in those days. But as a early to mid-age teenager, I remember seeing Dr. Strangelove on TV, commercial television, as a kid, and realized that you could use satire for political purposes. This was the film that gave me a sense that mainstream Hollywood American film could be commercially successful, artistically true to its perspective, and yet be remarkably funny about some of the most dire themes in human life, such as the extinction of Homo sapiens, the end of the world.
I think I'm slightly older than you. I was born in 56, but we're the same era, basically. So, of course, I do vaguely remember the Cuban Missile Crisis because, I was alive, obviously. I was in school, so I do remember bits and pieces of some of that. So, of course, you were in Australia, so it probably was a lot different than what we were experiencing in the United States. But I certainly have some memories of the period. But in my case, it was a matter that a friend of mine was a major Kubrick fan, and he's the one that we started with 2001, and like I said before, it was always back then, and given that Kubrick was never quick with his films, the big deal always was waiting for the next one. And so, of course, you ended up trying to see as many of you could, but like I said before, this was pre-home video, so the best you hoped for was a revival. So, for example, 2001, I'm sure I didn't see it when it first came out, but I know I saw it like on a revival. And, you know, luckily where we lived, it was not unusual to have these revivals where occasionally they would bring in films of directors. And I know it was a long, long time before I even saw Paths of Glory because it was just not easy to see and because Right. it wasn't being shown. So those days, that's how you figured it out. So obviously your interest in the film came up as part of your overall extensive experience in the issues related to nuclear warfare. But in reviewing your end notes, it's clear that this book alone has been a long project, or at least just a study of the film. Because some of your interviews, I noticed some of your interviews with Peter George's son was from back in 2005, it looks like.
So
was it always a matter that you were looking forward for a book, or was this some of these interviews meant for some of your other projects?
No, the genesis of this book on Dr. Strangelove really emerged in the late 1990s before Stanley died. So I'd been thinking about where do I go beyond nuclear movies. So I'd done this large kind of pattern recognition of all of these international films and really kind of glossed over the content so that I could make these large claims about this big body, you know, statistically 1,000 films from, 30 different countries, what the percentages were in different places. But it didn't give me the opportunity to really drill down into the detail that was necessary. And along the way, of course, I'd become a Kubrick fan, having seen this landmark film as a child, 2001, and then catching Dr. Strangelove later on TV. Of course, that started to switch me on to A Clockwork Orange, which was rated R in Australia, which was like your X rating in America. So I had to wait a little while till my late teens to be able to see that. But then Barry Lyndon came out, and I knew that I was really – witnessing modernist works of a master. These were kind of genius works that were pushing the boundaries on all kinds of levels. So probably like you, I went back to the back catalogue, looked at all the earlier films, and by about, as I say, the late 90s, I was an affirmed Kubrick fan and felt that if there was one film I was going to devote some time and energy towards exploring, I'd read all the articles and books about Kubrick up to that point and understood that the evolution and the genesis of Dr. Strangelove changed considerably. It had gone from a relatively straight, taut thriller to what became what Kubrick termed nightmare comedy. I had no idea at the time that it actually mutated across a number of parallel versions, but I didn't contact the family in the late 90s because I didn't quite know how to reach out to them. I'd initially gone through Warner Brothers to send a copy of my book, Nuclear Movies, to Stanley in the UK, but I never got a reply. I didn't expect to get a reply. But when I heard tragically he died in 99, just at the completion of Eyes Wide Shut, I didn't think it would be fair or wise to contact the family, you know, kind of indulgently to ask if I could work with them to access Stanley's archives. I knew that he had researched all of his films meticulously and had accumulated quite a large range of scholarly material. And this is evident now, of course, in the release of all the documents around the unfinished project of Napoleon, for example. So there was a news group that I was part of, the old alt dot Kubrick discussion group that I'd become a member of in the late 90s. And at one point, shortly after Stanley's death, his eldest daughter, Katharina, announced herself to that news group and was there really to kind of come on board to help demythify a lot of journalistic angles that were repeated endlessly about Kubrick's, you know, fear of flying, not traveling faster than, you know, 30 miles an hour in a car, all of this kind of stuff. So I reached out to her and said, look, I have this project. It's a scholarly work. I'm looking at the historical correlation between Cold War declassifications of documents that are starting to emerge and what your dad did at the time, and to see whether or not he was actually accurate, whether he's prescient, knowing increasingly that it looked like the type of work that he was doing with co-author Peter George was really tapping into the cutting-edge understanding of what was still highly classified, top-secret material to make a realistic representation in his film. So kindly, Katharina got back to me positively. She agreed to present that information to her mother, Christiana, and they were involved in a range of projects in the early 2000s around developing what became the large Stanley Kubrick archive book and, of course, the internationally touring archive project. So, and the documentary that Jan Harlan, his brother-in-law, executor, and longtime producer and executive producer, put together, you know, Stanley Kubrick, A Life in Pictures. So once they'd kind of cleared the deck a bit, they very graciously invited me to come and spend 2 weeks at the house in Chiliquibri, about 30 minutes north of London. And it was just such a pleasure, you know, to be a film historian and to be in the home of Stanley Kubrick, where inside his library on these two large tables were laid out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of boxes of photographs and documents and files. I was really like a kid in a candy store. So I was given unfettered access to that material. It was as yet uncatalogued. I took thousands of digital photographs, and the family gave me permission to use that as long as I wasn't reproducing the material without their photographically reproducing the material without their permission. And subsequently, most of that material was donated to the Stanley Kubrick Archive at the University of the Arts in London, which is open to anyone. So anyone listening to this program, if they're in the UK or planning to go to London and they're a fan of Kubrick or just curious, you can make an appointment and spend some time in the archive. They have a very comprehensive online finding guide. And there are seriously, you know, I don't know what the square meterage of storage that's in that facility, but there's artifacts as well as all of this meticulous material that he researched and kept. So I had an early access to that, and I spoke with a number of people in LA and also in London that were Kubrick collaborators around about 2004-2005, and I subsequently followed up with the sons of Peter George and Terry Southern. That's David George and Niall Southern. Subsequently, in other years, on repeat visits. So yes, this was a very long, drawn out project, but I'm glad it took me over a decade to do this, Joel, because two things occurred. One was, more and more material was being declassified and available through the National Security Archive, which again is a wonderful resource online that anyone can access. So all of these Cold War...
Yeah, I've looked at that material quite regularly myself, so I agree. You're mentioning sources that I've heard of and used myself, so they really are very great sources.
They're awesome. And again, this is the type of stuff that wasn't available when I first made that approach in the late 90s, early 2000s. So subsequent, you know, declassifications and release of material has done nothing but prove how accurate and how kind of uncannily prescient Kubrick, Peter George, and to some degree Terry Southern were in crafting this film, this screenplay, because there's an aspect of hyper-realism, particularly in the discourse, the accuracy of the kind of nuke speak that these characters present was based, of course, on people like Herman Kahn and other Rand Corp strategists and militarists at the time, Curtis LeMay, etc. So as the years passed, more and more material came out that just showed that the premise of this film was entirely legitimate and authentic, even though this was top secret. And these filmmakers were really kind of just joining the dots and trying to work out what could possibly be a realistic scenario that's plausible, that we could play straight, but play it for comedy as well.
And I know in one point of the book, you talk about how some members of the military did actually come on set at one point and looked at the radio that was only supposed to allow certain signals to come through, and how they were a little shocked that it looked much more real than they thought it was, than it should, and how basically Stanley was told, make sure that you've got proof for how you came up with all these things just in case, because it turns out some of them are a little more realistic than we thought.
Yeah, well, actually, that anecdote is Stanley saying to the production designer, Ken Adam, look, yeah, but you know, you've got the tone of it right. Look, just in case we get investigated, we better make sure that all the public sources are available for that. And what was fantastic about that film is that they had very few public domain sources that they could rely on, but they extrapolated out from that. So, for example, there was the cover of a book that showed the inside of a B-52 looking at the cockpit, and, you know, it probably showed a little bit more than a quarter of the front part of the cockpit. But from that, they could mirror that, they could extrapolate. Peter George, of course, had been a pilot with the RAF, and he understood intimately. He'd worked at British bases, NATO bases, and had intersected with, you know, American service personnel. There's one other anecdote that George's daughter, Sarah, told me, and that was he actually received a surprise visit from military intelligence, or possibly the CIA. So the author of Red Alert, or 2 Hours to Doom, as it was known in the UK, was visited prior to his work on Strangelove by some intelligence operatives, and they quizzed him about how he knew the location of where these Russian or Soviet-era nuclear facilities were. And he actually said, well, all I did was I got the map out and I worked out where it would be plausible that these things could be. So he was interrogated for a couple of hours, and Sarah relates the story that at the end they said, look, thanks for your cooperation, you've cleared this up. Oh, and by the way, the president, as in JFK, read your book and he liked it a lot.
I made sure, this is one of the things about Kubrick, is that, in fact, that was going to go into my next question. Kubrick was one of those, most of his films, in fact, I can think of only one that isn't based 100% on another source, and that's 2001, which was sort of developed over time. But most of his other works are based on written novels most of the time. And so, in fact, having read Red Alert recently, It really does follow the plot of that book quite a bit, except for the obvious changes of names and locations and the farcical parts of it. But Kubrick somehow figured out how to take that book and develop it, a good book, but obviously not a comedy, and still keep a good portion of the book in his story. But he also, one of the things your book really talks about is some of the other sources that he used, and you mentioned quickly Kahn. Of course, Kahn's most famous book on thermonuclear war was clearly one of Kubrick's most interesting sources that he used when he was developing this project.
Yeah, and Christiana, his wife, said that it was Paul Newman who gave Kubrick that book. And at one point when they were developing this as a serious thriller, Newman was penciled in as potentially, you know, most likely the principal actor in that version. Now, that didn't come to pass because, you know, when you get into the archives of these filmmakers and actors, you find that there are so many things that they're offered, and they have agents and lawyers that are kind of controlling and gatekeeping what they accept and what they don't accept. But, you know, many of these filmmakers and actors form these relationships over decades. For example, Gregory Peck was a close friend of Kubrick's, and they just never got the right stars to align for them to make a film together. So Newman passed on this book, and it's a bit of a cause de célèbre. I mean, in some ways, when On Thermonuclear War comes out, Kahn is attacked quite strongly, particularly by the left, as being an advocate of winnable nuclear war and survivability. And Kahn's response, of course, was, look, you know, we need to think about these things. We need to have a considered, logical, dispassionate, unemotive approach to this. And that's what I'm doing because, you know, there's too much emotive response to this from different kind of partisan positions. Now, Kubrick met with Kahn many times during the development of this project, and he and Christiana, for example, would meet him for dinner, and they'd be talking about mega deaths and tens, 20s of millions of, you know, fatalities, and working with the circular calculator that Dr. Strangelove pulls out in the sequences inside the war room, where he's calculating the half-life of cobalt thorium G, this kind of mythical, theoretical, long-lived radionuclide that brings about the doomsday shroud. But during these conversations, these were the type of slide rules that Kahn was referring to when he was talking to Kubrick and his wife. And I think I say in the book that Christiana related that they'd be driving back in a cab and they'd be looking at each other saying, did he say 100 million killed? No, I think it was like 200 million killed. And it was so bizarre, these statistics, these abstractions of human fatalities, that, of course, they started cracking up. It was gallows humor. It was black comedy. So this was a natural response, a kind of human way of dealing with the enormity, the magnitude of what a nuclear holocaust would be, that, of course, Kubrick, the genius and the brilliance of Kubrick was that he ultimately embraced this. He realized that, you know, to tell this story, to cut through the predisposition that we have in any partisan line, you know, the blockages that we have psychically about the enormity of this stuff, it's really got to be treated in a way that makes it some kind of shatteringly sick joke. That's the way artistically to present this. And he developed a number of screenplays in parallel, a range of different approaches to the material. And he decided ultimately, particularly bringing in Terry Southern, to turn what was a satirical script into, you know, some grotesque black humor, that this was the way to transmit this story. And as we know, Joel, this is what gives it life. You compare it with something like Failsafe. You know, these could have been two very similar films, but Dr. Strangelove remains in the zeitgeist and will do while there are nuclear weapons, and probably into the future, because people will look back on Dr. Strangelove is somehow capturing the insanity of mutual assured destruction and us going about our daily lives as if, you know, this stuff can't go off at any time. And, you know, Kubrick found a way to navigate through the complexity of the issues and the enormity of the consequences and deliver an artistic statement that stands the test of time, I think.
Well, and one of the other things, and this is where the issue continues to raise its ugly head, you would have, we, in some ways, everybody thought, well, the Cold War is over, so this is done. And yet now we're back into the period that, you know, in the cycles of the nuclear aspect of the Cold War, for example, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev were able to come up with a treaty to try to reduce the tensions related to the Cold War, to nuclear use, possible nuclear use, and the fact that it'll be enough to destroy the world. And yet, as you point out, in the 1980s, when we went through another period of Cold War rhetoric, suddenly the issue was, oh, we could live through a nuclear war. You know, that the possibility that it wouldn't destroy the world, and that, in, as you can imagine, as your as you've pointed out in other places, that's where it gets even more scary, because then people actually begin to think about using it because they think they can live through it. And that's why current rhetoric, even current political rhetoric, is particularly scary because of that kind of thought process.
Exactly right. So, and again, I think the brilliance of Kubrick is that he's not really just lambasting the nuclear mindset. It's really the political, military, industrial complex that somehow perpetuates a situation where arms are produced that are all weapons of mass destruction. These are kind of weapons against humanity in a mass scale. And somehow we've got to the point in our evolution as a species whereby we might bring about our own self-destruction in ways that historically will be seen as petty and so irrelevant that, you know, from any future perspective, they'll be unintelligible. And in some ways, this is why, and this is something that Peter Kramer picks up in his work on Kubrick, that 2001 was really a kind of necessary antidote to Dr. Strangelove. Now, there's a lot of pessimism and, you know, technological determinism in Strangelove, alienation by our technologies and our machines, and that, you know, the artificial intelligence becomes perhaps more human than the astronauts that inhabit the spaceship. However, Kubrick's actually coming up with Arthur C. Clarke to create a scenario where those opening satellites that you see orbiting the planet, unnamed nuclear weapons, but it's clear from all the drafts and from all the screenplays that this was meant to be represented as, in the 21st century, everyone, proliferation's got so crazy that everyone's got their own orbiting nuclear weapons platform. And somehow this is the time in which humans meet extraterrestrials that advance us to the next level, that moves beyond the folly of the continual threat of potential nuclear Armageddon, so that there'll be some evolutionary development in the species that will move beyond this very perilous period since, you know, World War II. You know, these 70 years that we've been living since World War II, where up until about the early 1960s, a nuclear war would have been absolutely catastrophic, but we now know in retrospect that with nuclear winters, it could bring about, you know, far greater destruction than was ever thought, even using a small proportion of this arsenal. So we are really living in this kind of period where there's almost an apocalypse that's forecast every year. And yet at baseline, we still have thousands of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert that could bring about a nuclear winter and pretty much devastate the planet. So I think what's happening in Dr. Strangelove is not just talking about a nuclear mindset, but what is it about our species? And this is an enduring interest of Kubrick. What is it about human frailty, hubris, you know, the sense of pride in our achievements that can get us to the point where we can actually extinguish ourselves? How do we pull back from that? So Kubrick was very clear that he may have had something of a pessimistic disposition, but as an artist, he was very keen to foreground the complexities, the idiosyncrasies, the juxtapositions of these types of geopolitical events that gave us the opportunity to reflect back critically on it. And that's the work of great artists.
Of course, you also talk about the military leaders of the time and how they fit into Kubrick's mindset with making the film. And of course, the most famous example is Curtis LeMay, but you talk a lot about some other folks who were in some ways even more scary than LeMay was. And anyone who doesn't know who Curtis LeMay was really needs to learn more about him, because if we want to talk about a possible nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he might have been able to start it right then. And he's famous for some of the things he was saying to Kennedy during that period of time, since so many of them are recorded. But yeah. The interesting thing is LeMay was just one example of the military leaders who were pretty prevalent in the Pentagon and other areas at that period.
Yeah, well, a lot of these guys, of course, had gone through World War II, and they had spent much of World War II, prior to the formation of the Strategic Air Command, involved in numerous missions and sorties where they were firebombing using napalm and other types of explosives, taking out military targets, but also incinerating cities. So LeMay and others were involved in really incinerating hundreds of thousands of civilians who happened to be part of urban industrial areas where munitions factories or, you know, army barracks or airfields were. So this kind of collateral damage, you would have to be a very hardened human being to get up every day, go to work, and, you know, send off a whole bunch of B-29s to bomb Tokyo and in one night kill 100,000 people. Now, LeMay said that he felt sure that, of course, if the Americans and the Allies had lost the war, he would have been tried as a war criminal. He knew that that was the perspective that was going to be bestowed on him. But, of course, he was part of the victorious Allies, and that wasn't the case. And he went on to form the Strategic Air Command. And his successor, Thomas Power, as you alluded to, was probably even more belligerent and seen as being more erratic and possibly bordering on the psychotic. So both LeMay and Power had pushed the boundaries of their military command to the points where they were trying to preempt a Soviet attack. And, of course, even the most minor Soviet attack on American military resources in those days during the Cold War would have led to massive retaliation, which by the late 1950s and early 1960s would have been probably 4,000 nuclear weapons across Eastern Europe and what was called the Sino-Soviet bloc. So, and while these were effectively directed towards airfields and other military assets, some missile bases, naval ports, of course, all of these assets are in highly dense urban areas. So you could never disaggregate a military target from civilian targets. And even locations that were far away from that, due to the ground bursts, SAC would be deliberately cratering all of these runways because they didn't want planes taking off or being able to come back and refuel. So they would be dropping thermonuclear weapons to crater these runways, and these would produce vast pools of radioactive clouds that would just – prevailing winds would take these hundreds, if not thousands, of kilometers downwind. And you could be a long, long way away in the middle of Siberia from any kind of major urban area, but, of course, you'd be dying from vast amounts of radiation that came as fallout. And, of course, fallout wasn't – discriminating. It would cross into the territories of allies. If you're nuking China, that means your allies in South Korea, in Japan, in the Philippines are all going to be downwind. And yes, I mean, these were genocidal weapons. They still are genocidal weapons. And the people that were leading the defense of the United States always had up their sleeve the capacity for a first strike. if they felt that continental, you know, the United States was under imminent threat. And one of the things that was poo-pooed at the time by the military and other advisors was that, oh, look, the plot of Dr. Strangelove is preposterous. We have safeguards that could prevent this from happening. But part of this declassification of documents that I was talking about earlier with the National Security Archive was that as early as the mid-1950s, President Eisenhower had secretly pre-delegated to senior lower echelon commanders their use without his authorization, pre-delegation, of nuclear weapons if it was required. In other words, if the president couldn't be communicated with, if he'd been taken out in some preemptive, you know, decapitating strike, then lower echelon commanders could retaliate. Now, that continued to be the case. Well, we still don't even know whether it's operating now, but it certainly continued to be the case throughout most of the Cold War into the 1980s, which meant that commanders-in-chief at various kind of regional areas in Europe, in the Pacific, in the Atlantic, and at their discretion, they could further delegate down to lower echelon commanders, such as a B-52 wing commander like the fictional General Ripper in Dr. Strangelove. So, again, this is all predicated on the idea that the chain of command's been interrupted, so we need to be able to retaliate, so we give these powers to act to these lower echelon commanders. That meant, logically, that those lower echelon commanders could unilaterally at any time issue those orders to attack without presidential approval. So this proved that Kubrick and Peter George, their scenario, was entirely accurate and prescient. And, you know, the question is, do those types of command and control provisions remain today?
I know, excuse me, a lot of what you've talked about are, as you've mentioned, have been from archives that have come available, and I can think of a few myself, and you mentioned some of them, such as, for example, the idea that somehow we were, the United States would be able to invade Cuba and somehow take it over and avoid nuclear war, missing the point that they didn't know at the time that they already had the nuclear weapons there in Cuba. At the time, the United States thought they hadn't gotten there yet and that they'd be able to do it without causing any issues. And as it turns out, we've since found out in the archives that the weapons were already there. And in fact, Castro was pushing Khrushchev to go ahead and use them. So, and then of course the other issue, and not related in the book or the film, is the issues of accidents. And you talk about Eric Schlosser's Command and Control book, in which he talks about a number of the accidents that happened that could have caused an incredible amount of destruction. And so you're right about the amount of material we're starting to see coming out of these archives.
And I think the point with those accidents or any type of interdiction that may lead from one thing to the next, you know, the capacity for humans to get it wrong, to not read the tea leaves correctly, despite, you know, the best human and, you know, surveillance intelligence technologies, it's clear that the CIA intelligence briefings to Kennedy at the time, which have now been released and you can look at, even though they're often heavily redacted, shows that there was a presumption that there were no nuclear weapons in Cuba. Therefore, when Curtis LeMay says we need to take out those surface-to-air missiles that are imperiling our U-2 overflights, and we need to attack, if we're attacked, we go in hard, we go in all the way, that had they done that, then this would have almost inevitably led to a local nuclear conflict with battlefield nuclear weapons. And that would have then escalated into a war between the hemispheres. And it's only because of the civilian control of those nuclear weapons and both Khrushchev and Kennedy staring down the hawks in their administrations, but also, as you mentioned, I mean, Castro was saying to Khrushchev, look, if there's a war, if we're attacked, we expect you to wipe out these imperialists. We want you to go to full thermonuclear war against the Americans. This is your kind of duty ideologically to get rid of capitalism. And Khrushchev's going, whoa, you know, it doesn't kind of work that way. You don't understand that really we are talking about the end of the world here. So it's just fascinating how these perspectives and the kind of intuitive things that people in the Pentagon or in the Kremlin were operating under, the assumptions of what their enemies were thinking or doing, were almost entirely wrong. And when you're dealing with the potential for global thermonuclear war, you know, I don't know whether you've seen that Errol Morris documentary, The Fog of War, about Robert McNamara. You know, when he puts his finger and his thumb up to his eye and looks down the barrel of the camera and says, we came this close to killing ourselves in nuclear war, this close, because of that kind of miscalculation on what the enemy was up to. It's just chilling.
Yeah, there is a documentary. Actually, it was probably, I don't think it was more than an hour, but I saw it on public broadcasting here in the United States. It was called Three Men Go to War, and it discussed the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was at the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of it. And one of the points that was made was that, and what people tend to forget is Castro in this whole thing. Many discussions of the Cuban Missile Crisis really only talk about Kennedy and Khrushchev, missing the point that Castro was an important cog. It was a three-prong issue, and some of the material we've since seen has proven that Castro was, you know, was the wild card in the whole thing that could have made it, you know, that could have easily made it just as bad or made it even worse if he had been able to go off completely.
Yeah, well, there's an extensive conversation after the Cuban crisis where a Soviet diplomat, senior diplomat, meets with Castro, and the nuclear weapons, the battlefield nuclear weapons, and some of the cruise, you know, the Soviet cruise missiles that are there in Cuba at the time that hadn't been removed because the Americans didn't know they were there. So Castro is saying, well, I hope you're going to leave these weapons. And even if the Soviets leave, we hope you're going to train our people to be able to use these weapons for self-defense. So Castro was actually pushing to have these, you know, 50 to 100 atomic weapons remain in Cuba so that he could unilaterally use them in case the Americans invaded. So fortunately, the Soviets said, no, no, no. They realized how erratic he would have been, how much of an ideologue he was. He was prepared to, you know, sacrifice Cuba for the sake of this kind of socialist revolution, that they withdrew those weapons, and they left some pretty ratty old planes and things like that for Castro to use. But at one point in late 1962, clocking over into 1963, Cuba could very well have been the third major nuclear state on the planet.
So let's move on. Like I say, most of the book deals with these kinds of issues related to how the story was developed and, you know, the real life situations. But then you also have some other parts of the book that are clearly built on your availability of the archives to you, which really make them particularly useful. So let's talk a little bit about the plagiarism lawsuit that came up with the writers of Failsafe. And you definitely were able to shed some new light on it, because obviously it's been known. The other writers have talked about the plagiarism suit, but you actually were able to review documents that pretty much showed that Kubrick and George, if not financially, certainly in a number of other ways, were able to pretty well prevail in that lawsuit.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there was a little bit of mythology around up until very recently, that Failsafe, the producers of Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, were in a kind of pitch battle about which film might be released first and whether or not plagiarism had occurred by the authors of Failsafe. The allegation was that they had plagiarized Peter George's underlying book for Dr. Strangelove, which was in America titled Red Alert. Now, there was a countersuit because one of the authors of Failsafe said that his earlier short story had been doing the rounds, wasn't published till after Peter George's book had come out, but it had been circulating, and he was actually going to counter that really George might have heard of this and potentially he was plagiarizing him. So anyway, once the lawyers got a hold of this, what Kubrick wanted to do was stop any film that could compete with his, even though he wasn't quite yet developing the satire, it still in this early period was potentially a straight thriller, but he was also working on a satirical version. But he encouraged Peter George to get a good solicitor and really look at suing Burdick and Wheeler, the authors of Failsafe, for plagiarism, because what this would do would be two things. One, it would create controversy and publicity. And I think, you know, Kubrick felt that any publicity was good publicity, and this would keep his production in the public's mind, in the industry journals, and also it would give Peter George the capacity to say, well, you know, if this project comes out before our project, I want to make it clear that I have all of these luminaries in the strategic policy analysis field that say mine is the landmark book and, you know, Failsafe is a subsequent book. So Kubrick also wanted to make sure that any film that he produced wouldn't be beaten to release by a faster production. And it looked like Failsafe would go into production before Dr. Strangelove, would be done quick and fast, Sidney Lumet with Max Youngstein's production company, doing a New York-based production, very short shooting period, a quick edit, and it would be out before Dr. Strangelove. So as it turned out, because of the controversy and because of the lawsuit by Peter George and then Stanley Kubrick and others joined that lawsuit, it meant that the production company that was overseeing Failsafe started to lose market attachment. People got very nervous about Youngstein's company, and the slate of productions that he had, of which Failsafe was going to be his launching platform, people started to withdraw investment. So at the end of the day, what happened was, because of the lawsuit and the controversy, Youngstein's company effectively folded, and the fire sale that went through his slate of productions, Columbia Pictures, that had already bankrolled Dr. Strangelove, picked up, you know, very, very cheaply, Failsafe. So because Columbia was now the kind of parent company of both of these productions, Kubrick said, look, you know, I need at least 6 months free rein on a release before Failsafe is released. So one of the provisions that was put in as part of the settlement, some cash went to Peter George in compensation, and this was not determined in the court. It was an out-of-court settlement. But there was a six-month provision whereby Strangelove would come out first, both nationally and internationally. So Kubrick would have really free rein for half a year for his film to reach its audience. And there was also a clause put in that no scenes from Failsafe, you know, images could really be put out as advanced publicity until that six-month period had lapsed. So as his former producer, James B. Harris, said, you know, this suit absolutely destroyed Failsafe's capacity to get real market and real audience appreciation. Had it come out first, it's highly unlikely that Strangelove would have been celebrated and despised in equal measure as this kind of controversial film. So Kubrick was very astute in his first role as a studio producer in organizing this campaign.
And you also point out that it was a good example of how Kubrick really did believe that in loyalty to the people he worked with, and that this wasn't just for obvious publicity, you know, for helping him for publicity, but he really did feel that Peter George was being wronged by this, and therefore he felt it was only part of his job as the producer and a friend of Peter George to make sure that he was defended against the whole situation.
That's right. And I think, you know, apart from a professional obligation, he clearly felt a moral and personal obligation. I mean, he'd become quite good friends with Peter George during the development. They worked intensely in New York, again, with Jimmy Harris at that point, and then subsequently. So that hot housing where, you know, these intense intellects were working day and night on these projects meant that they'd become very close. So George, of course, was aggrieved by the prospect of this book coming out that was going to steal his thunder. And for Kubrick, it was a win-win-win. Again, the professional and moral kind of obligation, but also it meant that it was getting free publicity. And thirdly, he could intervene to prevent a competing production coming out that may minimize his market impact.
So another chapter that you have in the book related that purposely does draws on the archives is the section dealing with deleted scenes. And most of them are pretty similar, are small and nothing surprising. But one of the things you were able to do was to really detail the pie fight scene, which of course is very famous from the film because everybody seems to know that it was there, that it got cut. But you really were able to discuss it in detail, literally almost frame by frame, to explain what the pie fight scene actually showed, even though it didn't make it into the final film. So that was another aspect of the book that I found particularly interesting, because you showed how was it supposed to fit into the final film.
Yeah, well, one of the nice things of the donation of all of this production material to the Stanley Kubrick Archive that I first accessed in 2005 in London was the daily continuity reports that the studio required. So this would be where the continuity person would be marking up a page that would say what the slate was, what the take was, who the director of photography was, who the director was, what the scene was, what the date was, what the camera setup was, what the lines were verbatim for each take, where the fluffs were, where the technical errors were, and also, more importantly, what was printed, what Kubrick decided to print of all of those takes. So it gave me this mosaic of like a paper trail, really, that I could match with the existing recollections of people, because the pie fight sequence was cut out of the film very reluctantly but ultimately fortuitously by Kubrick. And only one print remains at the BFI, and that's not available for anyone to see. So a couple of people have seen it, and Terry Southern, for example, wrote a very interesting article reflecting on the filming of it and also the scene he saw. I worked and interviewed with Pablo Ferro, who edited that sequence, cut it up. He also did the opening montage sequence of the refueling B-52 and the final sequence of the montage of the atomic explosions. So, you know, Ferro also gave me an insight into the way they were choosing different frame rates. So the scenes were shot, but they also cut these up to make it look more slapstick-like, and that they'd used a pianist that had been involved in working on silent films. So this really was going to be almost a Keystone Cops slapstick pie fight. But they tried very, very different approaches to frame rates. At one point, for example, even at the end with Vera Lynn's We'll Meet Again, Pablo Ferro and Kubrick discussed the idea of having a follow the bouncing ball. So the lyrics would be presented as subtitles with a bouncing ball going across, "We'll meet again." So you know, these guys were trying everything. They really wanted to think of every possible angle and approach that would best suit the material. So at the end of the day, what these continuity reports enable you to do is kind of forensically match the myth of what's been described in the literature and kind of counter some inaccuracies of people's recollections, because you can see what was filmed and what wasn't. For example, you know, some people say that, you know, Kubrick used three cameras on Peter Sellers all the time and, you know, took multiple takes of everything. Well, it's clear that during the pie fight, there was no more than two cameras ever used, and they shot no more than two takes on anything. So these continuity reports, and with some arduous historical reconstruction, you can really get a good sense of even the kind of mise-en-scène, the placement of objects within the frame, how the camera was moving. Was it a reverse dolly? Was it a crane shot that lowered down to concentrate on an aspect of, you know, Sellers and Peter Ball making these elaborate kind of sandcastles out of the whipped cream pie, you know, regressing into their childhood as part of the shock of, you know, the appalling events that were going to lead to the end of the world. So this type of access to primary historical material is not only entirely gratifying for me as a film historian, but it really does give you some certainty about saying, okay, I can definitively say this happened or this didn't happen, and correct or support the existing literature.
I know there are some stills from the pie fight sequence around, but you're right. I know, who knows when, if anyone will ever be able to see the full pie, you know, the footage of it, which Kubrick was clearly, even, you know, he was obviously still alive during the beginnings of home video, and he definitely was one of those directors who believed that what he believed, you know, he said everything he needed to say on the screen, and therefore adding to it wasn't really that important. I know that Steven Spielberg's another one, a director who doesn't mind supplementary material, but still believes that he doesn't need to do commentaries, whatever. He's said everything that needs to be said, and I suspect that was one of those things that they both shared.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right there, Joel, because Jan Harlan has told me that, you know, Stanley was absolutely adamant that this was not to be seen. In some ways, it was almost a historical circumstance that the BFI got this copy. And Jan said, look, as his executor, I mean, there is no way this will ever be released, you know, during my lifetime. So anyone that's kind of holding their breath to see this as a DVD or a Blu-ray add-on in future, I think it's probably highly unlikely. But the main point you made is the right one, and that's that Kubrick's films are so rich, and he made it perfectly clear and articulated a number of times that he was only interested in films, making films that would be so dense and rich that people could come back and appreciate over and over again. And I think this is the brilliance of Kubrick's work, and, you know, demonstrates his artistic genius, is that you can come back to these films repeatedly and you will be endlessly rewarded with new things. And, you know, this is not the type of work that we associate with mainstream, you know, commercial, fairly ephemeral filmmaking. Kubrick was clearly deeply researching long before going into pre-production on any project. While making films, he was actively seeking input from members of the cast, members of the crew. He would listen and take opinions from anybody, because he wasn't arrogant to think that he knew it all or he had all the answers. And in fact, during editing, many of the things that he shot were discarded precisely because he didn't really know what he wanted until he saw it on screen and edited. So the fact that he'd excised material was for a reason. So I can't exactly say what those reasons are. I can only surmise and offer some interpretations as to why some of those sequences were removed. For example, I detail how Slim Pickens, as Major Kong, sings this kind of cowboy lullaby. And in some ways, it would be hilarious to see this bit of footage where Slim's taken his hands, sorry, Slim's taken the plane off autopilot and is banking left and right, singing this kind of cowboy song, "Get along, little doggy." I mean, it would be wonderful to see, but of course, it no doubt would have slowed down the film. And as you know, the soundtrack with when Johnny comes marching home, there's a cadence, there's a rhythm, there's a pacing to build up tension. So you can understand why this long, elaborate, you know, cowboy ode was excised. But it must have been a hell of a lot of fun to film and watch being made.
That's one of the things about Dr. Strangelove. It's almost real time when you think about it. I mean, the whole thing's supposed to happen over 2 hours, and even though the film's less than 2 hours, most of the action seemingly is happening real time. We get regular reports of time, for example, where they're 20 minutes away from being picked up by Russian radar, and we regularly get those kind of reports throughout. So Kubrick was clearly trying to make sure to keep the, even with a comedy, the suspense part of it, he still didn't lose that as part of the overall filmmaking. But I also wanted to mention, speaking of Blu-rays, is that I know that even though the film was already released on Blu-ray years ago, there's a recent Criterion edition of the film, in which I was watching recently, and then discovered that you were actually in the supplementary materials. There's an interview with you, or actually, it's not really, you don't really talk with anybody, but you make a lot of points, many of which are in your book, in the supplementary video.
Yeah, so Criterion were very kind to invite me to participate in that. And like all things, Joel, you give like a 2-3 hour interview, unlike you, which will run extensively. But of course, they have to cut things down and make sure that you're not duplicating what other people are saying. So what I concentrate on in this edit for Criteria is really Kubrick's role as a fully fledged first-time studio producer. So he's already a writer, co-writer, director, but he takes on the role of a studio producer once James B. Harris extricates himself from what was going to become Dr. Strangelove, and he goes on to make, with Kubrick's blessing and support, The Bedford Incident, also with Columbia a year later, also a nuclear thriller. So but there's also other very good interviews, including Richard Daniels, the Stanley Kubrick archivist in London, who was fantastic, helpful, facilitating me, bending over backwards to help me get access to material that was originally at the Kubrick home, but then was donated to the Stanley Kubrick archive in London. So Richard's interview is also quite impressive.
Well, I know some of the material in supplementary is some of the material that's already been out, but there's enough new material, plus the print itself is better than the previous one. I think it looks better than the one that came out that Columbia issued some years ago. But so it's definitely worth reaching out, even though the film has already been on Blu-ray. So I hope people will make a point of viewing it again, but from a different, a different company. Criterion deserves the support for films like for what they do.
And there's a great little essay and booklet that the production design of the Criterion Blu-ray it mimics some of the production material in the Kubrick film, and it's fun.
So, what are your current projects? Do you have anything you want to mention that are either coming up or that you're working on that going forward now that you've finished this long project?
Sure. Well, there's a few balls in the air. A couple of longstanding projects is a kind of similar historical treatment to On the Beach, not so much as richly archivally based, but looking at how On the Beach was originally a novelization in the newspaper that then became a novel, that then became a film, that then became a radio adaptation, that then became a TV miniseries, and now apparently is going to be a libretto for a modern opera. So On the Beach is most famous as a novel and, of course, the Stanley Kramer film, but it has these other lives, these other manifestations culturally at different times. So what I want to try and do is look at how the story of On the Beach, the plot of On the Beach, resonates differently in these different media. How was it presented in the newspaper? What was its strengths and weaknesses as a novel, as a film, as a mini series? What were the different radio adaptations? So that's kind of one project, but also to marry that with what's going on geopolitically at the same time that those different formats for telling that story occur. Another work I'm looking at, which has been percolating away for a little while, is a large book on the Mad Max, now Quartet. I started working on this while it was still a trilogy, but with the 2015 release of Fury Road, a lot of things have changed, a lot of things have remained the same. So I'm interested in George Miller coming back to this project and what it means in the 21st century, what's changed. And, you know, this fascination we have with the apocalyptic, the end of the world that never seems to go away. We just have variations on it from time to time. So I guess you could say, Joel, the end of the world's been good to me.
Well, one of the things, there's so much in Dr. Strangelove. Your book really spends most of its time talking about the development and the geopolitical aspects in many ways, plus some of the other background material. Doesn't even spend much time with the actual filmmaking part. You know, you don't do a film analysis. That's not really necessary. Anybody can do those. But there's still so much fascinating, you know, from Kubrick's long takes, which are just unbelievable, and how he handled certain things. And frankly, I would love to know, where did he come up with, you know, how did he pick up on the fluoridation conspiracy theory, given that that was a real conspiracy theory at the time, and yet it ends up becoming part of the plot. Of course, wasn't before. So there's so much there, but I still, you know, what you presented and what you pulled together was just a great, great background information that presents all kinds of new light on the film and on Kubrick.
Yeah, well, thanks, Joel. I mean, you know, there's still, as I say in the book, there's volumes to be written on that. And, you know, the fluoridation story is a fascinating one with the John Birch Society. And I think Terry Southern certainly, you know, contributed much of the dialogue around that because – you know, that's something that his talent, his sardonic humor was brilliant in embellishing those lines.
Well, once again, I really appreciate your time, and this has been a great discussion, and I hope that more people reach out for your book and also some of your other works, because as I say, as you pointed out, the end of the world, it's become the norm anymore. Probably just about every writer wants to do a dystopian novel of some sort. So as a topic, it's continues to be important both for fiction, but also current events and history. So thanks for talking to me, Mick. I really enjoyed our discussion.
Yes, thanks very much. If I can just leave one little epilogue for listeners, and that's that Katharina Kubrick reminded me that her dad, Stanley, said she just hoped Dr. Strangelove wouldn't one day become a documentary.
Unfortunately, if it does, it'll be one that no one will likely see.
Except we won't meet again.
Except maybe the aliens, which was one of the things, that one of the initial ideas behind the film was supposed to be a view from aliens who discovered what happened. So that was one of the
right.
Very many versions.
Dead Planets of Antiquity, and indeed Kubrick used that same idea with the robot AIs that at the end of AI that find the little boy underwater.
Well, thanks again.
Okay, you take care.
My thanks to Mick. His book is not only a spectacular review of a great artist and a great film, but a useful example of how movies can actively examine and portray real life and events. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film.